All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket today. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 090073, Merck and Company versus Felicia Garza et al. From Starr County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. Justice Willett and Justice Guzman are not sitting in that cause. Docket number 081044 in the matter of B.W. from Harris County and the 1st Court of Appeals District, and 091005 Transcontinental Insurance Company versus Joyce Crump from Fort Bend County in the 14th Court of Appeals District, and Justice Guzman is not sitting in that case. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in the first cause, Merck and Company versus Felicia Garcia.
May it please the court, Mr. Stephen G. Tipps will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Court. This case presents at least three important questions concerning the court's landmark Havner opinion. First, was the totality of the evidence review mentioned on page 720 of the opinion intended by the court to override the specific requirements for epidemiological studies that the court had painstakingly established in the preceding five pages? We submit that the answer to that question is no, because a totality of the evidence review makes sense only if the plaintiff first has satisfied the minimum requirements established in Havner for using epidemiological studies to prove causation.
Second, are clinical trials
among the epidemiological studies covered by Havner's requirements? We submit that the answer to that question is yes, because clinical trials are simply one form of epidemiological study, all of which address only the question of whether or not there is an increase in the risk of a disease associated with a particular drug, and like all epidemiological evidence, they can satisfy this state's more likely than not burden of proof only if they show a relative risk greater than 2.0. And third, do the studies identified by the Garzas in this case, which now number an even dozen, satisfy Havner's requirements? We submit that the answer to that question is no. The chart filed late yesterday afternoon by the Garzas notwithstanding, not only can the Garzas not point to two such studies, which is what Havner requires, they cannot point to even one. Let me first address the question of whether Havner establishes minimum requirements. With its opinion in this case, the San Antonio Court of Appeals has placed itself in a distinct minority among Texas intermediate appellate courts in its interpretation of Havner.
Virtually all of the other courts of appeals that have addressed
this question, including two other panels of the San Antonio Court, have held either explicitly or by implication that Havner established minimum requirements for epidemiological studies.
But now, when they talked about those studies, they were talking about observational studies.
The studies at issue in Havner were observational studies.
And you'd agree that clinical trials are more reliable than observational studies.
Clinical trials are more reliable than observational studies, but the Havner opinion established the requirements for all epidemiological studies. Epidemiological studies are divided by scientists into two categories, either experimental studies or observational studies. Clinical trials are an example of experimental epidemiological studies. And the significant thing about the court's opinion is that what the court did was contrast a controlled scientific experiment which can prove a direct cause and effect relationship with epidemiological studies that can only show an increase in risk. And clinical trials, just like observational studies, do nothing more than show an increase in risk.
But now clinical trials are what Merck relies on to get this product to market. Isn't that right?
Clinical trials are what Merck relies upon and what any drug manufacturer relies upon.
Well, then why shouldn't that enhance the reliability behind clinical trials as opposed to observational studies?
It should. And that's where the court's totality of the evidence review comes into play. As I read Havner, as most of the courts of appeals have read Havner, as at least three district courts sitting in Texas have read Havner, Havner establishes minimum requirements for all epidemiological studies. And if a plaintiff seeking to rely upon epidemiological studies to prove causation cannot show that there are at least two statistically significant studies that show more than a doubling of the risk at the same dose and duration and also satisfy Havner's exclude other causes requirement, then the plaintiff has not met Havner's requirements and has not established the necessary causation. At that point, if the plaintiff, though, has met those requirements, what the court said in Havner is that that's not enough, that the court, the gatekeeper, the trial court as the gatekeeper, still needs to look at the totality of the evidence. And it is at that point that a court should give more weight to clinical trials than to observational studies. For example, if all a plaintiff had were two observational studies showing a relative risk or odds ratio of 2.01, that might not be enough because all of the other factors, the Bradford Hill factors, the Henley-Cook postulates, all of those other factors might not satisfy the gatekeeper that the studies are scientifically reliable. On the other hand, if the epidemiological studies upon which the plaintiff has relied to meet the minimum requirements are clinical trials, then presumably a relative risk of 2.01 might well be satisfactory. But the problem with the, or one of several problems with the San Antonio court's opinion is that it suggests that clinical trials should not be subjected to Havner's minimum requirements, and yet it offers nothing as an alternative, and basically says that the court simply is to look at all of the, if there are clinical trials, the court is to look at all of the evidence, and if in its judgment, its subjective judgment, the studies are scientifically reliable, then that's enough. I mean, that is the very ipsy-dixit regime that this court addressed and changed in Havner. I think also a simple reading of the court's opinion in Havner should lead the court to the opinion that Havner established minimum requirements. The totality of the evidence language is in the final or the next to the last paragraph of Section 4 of the opinion. Section 4 of the opinion is the section in which the court undertook, quote, to consider the use of epidemiological studies and the more likely than not burden of proof. And the court then went on in that section to establish to say that one of the requirements is to show a more than doubling of the risk, that the court should apply the Bradford Hill factors, the court should look at the design and execution of the studies, the court should look at the dose and duration and make sure that it's comparable to what the plaintiff experienced, and the court should see if other plausible causes were excluded with reasonable certainty. When read in that context, it seems to me, and it seems to other courts that have interpreted this court's opinion, that the court is to undertake a totality of the evidence review only if those minimum requirements have been met. And quite frankly, it seems to me that it would make no sense for the court to have wasted all the time and effort to establish those minimum requirements if at the end of the day the issue was to be left to the trial judge in his or her discretion.
You said that notwithstanding the chart that was submitted by the plaintiffs yesterday that those requirements have not been met. How do you distinguish this chart that they've given to us yesterday on the bench today?
Well, we of course have a battle of charts. We submitted the chart early in the day and they submitted a chart later in the day. Simply put, if you look through the 11 studies that the Garzes have identified on their chart, you will not find one that shows a more than doubling of the risk, that is to say a relative risk of greater than 2.0, that is statistically significant at this dose, which is 25 milligrams, and this duration, which is less than 30 days. There's not one such study. I would submit that probably the study on their list that comes the closest, which ironically is not even a study, is Victor. And they rely with regard to Victor on an item that they've attached as tab B of their handout. That is nothing more than an email with regard to a study that was never completed that expressed some preliminary findings. And one of the tests said no statistical significance, one said statistical significance at a relative risk greater than 3.0. But when the court established requirements for epidemiological studies in Havner, I don't think it intended to mean that a plaintiff can prove causation indirectly by submitting an email setting forth preliminary findings in an epidemiological study that was never completed. Preliminary findings change. The evidence in the record is that this is not something that scientists would rely upon. And the final point is that we objected to testimony by their expert concerning this very chart that's attached as tab B to their handout, and the court sustained the objection.
Mr. Tibbs, can there ever be a situation where the risk factor is slightly less than 2, so 1.8, 1.9, and there's other evidence to boost this doubling of the risk factor, or maybe not boost it, support it? Can that ever be considered by the trier of fact, or is it 2.0 period? If you don't meet that threshold, case is over.
Well, this court, of course, identified that as an issue in Havner and did not specifically did not address it. The court cited to the Ninth Circuit's opinion in Dalbert 2, which is the Ninth Circuit reconsideration of Dalbert when it was sent back by the Supreme Court, and Judge Kaczynski in that case included a footnote in which he hypothesized that in a case, he made the assumption of a case in which someone was suing for a birth defect claiming that his mother was a smoker and smoking caused the birth defect. And he hypothesized a situation in which there was one study with regard to smokers that showed a 1.5 relative risk and one study with regard to drinkers that showed a 1.8 relative risk. And he speculated that perhaps an expert might come in and reanalyze that data. And he made the assumption that the mother in question was not a drinker, but she was a teetotaling smoker, and so that drinking would be a confounding factor. And he speculated that perhaps if a study like that could be reanalyzed, maybe it would come up with 2.0. There are a handful of courts around the country that have talked about this. Some courts have mentioned that maybe if the plaintiff had a specific genetic factor that predisposed him or her to a particular condition, that might be enough. But I would suggest that the court should be very wary of allowing that kind of exception for the simple purpose that, according to the court's analysis in Havner, a relative risk of 2.0 of greater than 2.0 is necessary to satisfy this state's more likely than not burden of proof. And as the court cited in its example in Havner, if you have a situation in which 6 out of 1,000 people will have a disease for natural causes, and you have a study that shows that in the study 9 of the 1,000 had the disease, well, you would conclude that it's not more likely than not that any one of those persons contracted the disease because of the drug. It's more likely that they had it for natural causes. And it's only if more than 12 of the 1,000 who've taken the drug contract the disease that you've satisfied the more likely than not burden of proof.
So what guidance can we give to a trial judge who tries these cases, which are so difficult because there's always a battle of experts, and he's trying to weigh this evidence, and they're given this great authority to be the gatekeeper of this evidence. And if it's close, if they exclude it, then you take away the case from the plaintiff. If you let it in, then the jury's going to help decide these issues, and maybe we evaluate there. What guidelines can we give them on these type of cases that are so close?
Well, I think the court established good and clear guidelines in Havner, which include that there be at least two studies that show a more than doubling of the risk.
But reasonable minds do differ. I mean, you have a trial judge in the same jurisdiction deciding the same case one way, exclude the evidence, and the judge right down the hall would allow this evidence. I mean, these cases are that close.
That can be true, but a study either has a relative risk of more than 2.0 or it does not. A study either is statistically significant or it's not. If the confidence interval includes 1.0, it's not statistically significant.
That seems like an easier case to decide there.
Well, I mean, those are the standards that the court gave trial judges in Havner. And I think those standards can be applied by trial judges. They are applied by trial judges all across the state of Texas.
Who controls these clinical studies when they're done? Is it the
typically the clinical study in a prescription drug case is commissioned by the drug manufacturer, but the study is done by doctors, scientists, researchers. I don't think there's any, I mean, these are legitimate scientific studies. They are published in journals. They are peer-reviewed, which, of course, is one of the factors under Robinson. I think that the regime that the court established in Havner is a good one that courts have been following, that this court failed to follow in this case because, I mean, as I pointed out before, if there were two studies that met the Havner requirements, the Garzas would be up here telling you these are the two studies. Now, maybe Mr. DuBose for the first time is going to come up and say, well, I finally figured out which they are. But we don't have that. They keep pointing to 12 different studies, not one of which satisfied the requirements.
When was the trial?
I think it was in early 2005.
There have been studies, if you know, post-trial that would satisfy the doubling of the risk.
There have been studies that have come out post-trial. I do not believe that there has been any study that would satisfy Havner's requirements in this case, at this dose and this duration. And I think it's very important for the court to focus on the fact that this case is really only about short-term use of Vioxx, 25 milligrams, less than 30 days. And I don't believe that there's any study that would suggest that that can cause heart attack.
In their brief, respondents say that a Merck employee, Shapiro, prepared a cardiovascular meta-analysis about Vioxx that showed a 95% confidence interval and a doubling of the risk. Address that one.
First of all, no expert for the plaintiffs ever mentioned the Shapiro study. And so...
Mentioned at trial?
Not mentioned at trial. So no opinion was expressed with regard to the Shapiro study, number one. Number two, the Shapiro study is a meta-analysis in which you look at multiple studies, including the Vigor study. The Vigor study was a large study, 50 milligrams, 9 months use. The Vigor results heavily influenced the Shapiro results. And as we have pointed out in the chart that we filed with the court and directed the court to the particular parts of the record, if you exclude Vigor from the Shapiro meta-analysis, the relative risks are like 1.09 or 1.19 and not statistically significant.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Tipp.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument now from the respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Kevin DuBose will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court. In the Havner opinion, this court said, the law must balance the need to compensate those who have been deeply injured by the wrongful actions of another with the concept deeply embedded in our jurisprudence that a defendant cannot be found liable for an injury unless the preponderance of the evidence supports cause and fact.
Let me just ask you,
sure.
This 2.0 threshold, does your case rise and fall on that? When I read your response, it seemed to me like you were producing numbers that yielded what Havner, the other side argues, would require. I mean, if do you win or lose on that basis?
It depends on how you apply that 2.0 standard. If you isolate each test by itself and say it has to meet every one of these standards, then I think there are two of our tests that we rely on that do that. One is the Victor study that was mentioned a while ago, which had the required statistical significance, the 95% confidence level, greater than 2%, greater than double the risk, and events began to occur immediately. In the bench exhibit that we filed, tab B, is the report from the Victor study, and it says several significant things. First of all, even though that study was discontinued because of another study where the results were so bad that Merck said, we better pull this drug off the market and discontinue Victor. But in the first paragraph of that report and under tab B, they say, here are the preliminary results, but we don't expect these results to change. The other thing about that study is if you look at the chart, it shows the occurrence of serious cardiovascular events, and they start occurring immediately.
Mr. DeBose, was that into evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. On page 2 of opposing counsel's chart, it shows a Victor not in evidence, not yet published at trial.
It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 111, Your Honor.
Okay.
And it was admitted. So the Victor study, we think, has all the elements. The other thing is the Shapiro meta-analysis that Merck was just talking about. It's not a clinical study. It is a meta-analysis, but that's where Merck asked one of their own employees.
But that wasn't introduced at trial?
No, it was introduced at trial, and that was...
It says it was relevance evidence. Relevance objection was sustained from that chart. So was it actually admitted?
It was, Your Honor. Let me first of all, it was admitted as Exhibit 130, Plaintiff's Exhibit 132. Here's the story regarding the...
It seemed to be a hard question. Was the exhibit admitted at trial? Or?
Yes, Your Honor. Plaintiff's Exhibit 132, it was admitted at trial. There was never any objection to the admission of the exhibit. In the discussion of the exhibit, at one point, counsel for Merck made an objection to relevance, and the court said, I'm inclined to agree with you, counsel. Counsel, please move on to something else. But it was discussed by the experts. There was one objection. It was not ruled on one way or the other, and certainly there was not an objection to this Exhibit 132, and it was admitted into evidence.
But her study was not an epidemiological study.
It was not an epidemiological. It was a meta-analysis, which scientists do rely upon. It was commissioned by Merck, and it studied all of evidence at that time about VIOPS, both clinical trials and epidemiological studies.
If you have to have an epidemiological study, then your case rises or falls on the Victor study?
The Victor study is the best one we have. As I said, there's no point where Havner says you have to apply all of these considerations to every single test, and if they fail one, they suddenly become no evidence. It's kind of like in the Daubert Robinson analysis, where you have the six non-exclusive factors that this court has said you consider. It has never said if you lose on one of these, then it's no evidence. It just said these are considerations. These are indicia of reliability. Mm-hmm. And that's what Havner talks about in the Havner opinion. It never says we are setting out a mathematical formula. In fact, there are numerous places where the court specifically says we're not doing that.
This Counsel, before you go into that in detail, let me just be clear. Assuming that the Havner standards require to meta-analysis, clinical trials, course epidemiological studies, are you saying there are two that satisfy the Havner requirements?
Satisfy all of the requirements. That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. Victor and the meta-analysis.
The Shapiro meta-analysis, right. In the Havner opinion itself, the court talks about these scientific considerations, but after doing so, And the court, as I said, we're not coming up with this language on our own, and the court didn't. The court turned to the field of science in an effort to meld the scientific and the legal analysis. And it said that we do not hold that a relative risk of more than 2.0 is a litmus test. Other factors must be considered. The strong consensus among epidemiologists is that conclusions about causation should not be drawn until a number of criteria have been considered. In another place, the opinion says, there are a number of reasons why reliance on a relative risk on 2.0 as a bright-line boundary would not be in accordance with sound scientific methodology.
But the context of that discussion in Havner seemed to be that, you know, if you prove 2.0, that doesn't establish liability either. I mean, that seemed to be the tone that was written in, that just because you meet 2 doesn't mean you've established it.
Well, not just the tone. But a sentence or two before that, it says, we also note that some of the literature indicates must consider a relative risk of less than 3 to indicate a weak association. It seems that in that paragraph, as Justice O'Neill suggests, that the 2 is a minimum rather than a maximum.
If I can direct you to one other place in the opinion, Justice Sec, at 7, 8, 18, the court says, There may be, in fact, no causal relationship even if the relative risk is high. Likewise, even if a particular study reports a low relative risk, there may, in fact, be a causal relationship. The court really bounced. It said the fact that you've got over 2.0 doesn't guarantee that it's reliable. The fact that you're under doesn't mean it's necessarily unreliable, that you consider all of these factors. And at the end of all of these discussions about the factors you consider, the court said, we emphasize that courts must make a determination of reliability from all the evidence. Courts should allow a party, plaintiff or defendant, to present the best available evidence, assuming it passes muster under Robinson, and that's not a challenge in this case. And only then should a court determine from a totality of the evidence, considering all of the factors affecting the reliability of particular studies, whether there is legally sufficient evidence to support a judgment.
One other such factor is disproving other possible causative factors. Was that done here? Petitioners make a point of explaining how, fortunately, Mr. Garza was advanced in age, obese, had smoked for 40 years, most of that time, several packs a day. Had high blood pressure issues, had cholesterol issues, had a quadruple bypass and other facts in the record. And they say that just the advance of those cardiac conditions and the other medical conditions is what caused his untimely death. Were those addressed and disproven?
They certainly were, Your Honor. And you have to look at two things. First of all, you have to look at Mr. Garza's condition shortly before his heart attack. And then you have to look at the findings from the autopsy about what caused the heart attack. In terms of his condition, this case is somewhat unusual in that exactly at the point when he started taking Vioxx, he had a full cardiac workup. And that told us several things. His cardiologist concluded, based on that workup, that he had a stable cardiac status. There was a very small area of diminished blood flow at the very tip of his heart, which wasn't anywhere close to where the fatal clots occurred. They did a carotid Doppler test showing minimum plaquing, no flow obstructing lesions, and the arteries were not life-threatening. They showed a 60% ejection fraction, which means every time the heart pumps, 60% of the blood empties and flows back in, which sounds kind of scary to me, but they said that's actually a good number for ejection fraction, and it is a good predictor of staying alive longer. And his blood pressure was normal, his cholesterol was under control, he cut back his smoking to two or three packs a day. So that's the picture you have just before he had his heart attack. And there was a statistical study that the expert relied on from Circulation Magazine, a medical journal showing 5,000 patients, that said that for someone with a history of a heart attack, which he had, and a mildly abnormal thallium scan, which he had, there's a 1.4 to 2.0 chance of dying from a heart attack within the next year. So in contrast to those facts about his condition just before it happened, we have the autopsy that shows that the cause of his heart attack was two fresh occlusions. And the experts testified that that means they did not exist at the time he started to take Vioxx, a drug known to cause clots, and that he probably had the clot for the first time on the day when he had the heart attack. That these two, there were two clots that developed in two different arteries. And experts on both sides said this was rare or unusual to have two heart clots develop at once. The chance of a fatal clot over the next year being 1% to 2%, the fact that it would happen twice at the same time is extremely rare. And you add to that fact that the only thing that had changed about his treatment between the time of his stable cardiac status and his heart attack is that he started taking Vioxx, a drug known to cause clots. So what the Havner opinion requires is that we negate causes with reasonable certainty, and based on the expert evidence, and we did do that. We negated that cause with reasonable certainty.
Back to the studies, the Chief Justice asked opposing counsel whether there have been any studies since this trial. What's your answer to that?
I know that I've read about some, Your Honor. I haven't bothered to study them because I didn't want to go outside the record, but I can't really answer that. I just know that I remember seeing some.
And what is the status of the Vioxx litigation around the country? Are you?
I know that there was a class action Vioxx that was settled, but I don't know the terms, and I don't know if there are any other pending cases.
Or whether there's ongoing litigation in other...
I'm just not aware, Your Honor.
Or are there Texas courts, do you know, or appellate courts?
I'm just not aware, Your Honor. With regard to the suggestion that this is the only court that has ever interpreted Havner in the way that it has, I beg to differ with that. Another San Antonio Court of Appeals case called Texas Workers' Compensation versus Lopez, 21 Southwest 2nd, 358, said that our reading of Havner does not reveal a clear indication that a doubling of the risk is necessary for statistical significance. In Havner, there were 30 studies that had all concluded that Bendectin did not cause birth defects. Against this backdrop, the Supreme Court criticized the Havner scientific evidence and set a high standard for the use of epidemiological studies in the face of contrary scientific belief. In the present case, the scientific evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of the Lopez proposition. That's what we've got in this case, and that's why it's so different from Havner. In Havner, there were 30 published peer review studies that said Bendectin did not cause this particular heart attack. So these few epidemiological studies that the experts were relying on, unpublished, not peer-reviewed, and in each of the studies the experts relied upon, the author of the study had reached the opposite conclusion of what the expert said. Whereas in our case, every one of the studies that we've shown shows that there is an increased risk of heart attack with biopsy.
But none show causation. They show an association, right? You can't get to causation with epidemiological studies, right?
The third restatement that just recently came out, Your Honor, addresses that and talks about the difference between epidemiological studies and clinical trials. And it says that all scientific proof of causation is based at some level on inference. And there's a question of at what level do you tolerate the inference and what you don't. Clinical trials are the gold standard, as it's been called, the highest level of reliability of scientific tests. As opposed to epidemiological study. So what we think the court should do is consider a number of indicia of reliability, one of which is whether it's a clinical trial or an epidemiological study, clinical trial being much more reliable. I also think you should look at where the study comes from, what the chances are from bias, and most of the studies we rely on were done by Merck. It's not junk science, it's Merck science that we're relying on.
I think it's very relevant. Having experienced a myocardial infarction a couple of years ago, there's a drug, Zadia, that was recently talked about in some scientific journal as leading or may contribute to heart attacks. And in this instance, my wise doctor prescribed that to me, and I read this article, and I quit taking it. But then I read that there's a the company behind it is the competitor. So how is a trial judge or whoever's reviewing these studies, how do they determine that these studies are indeed reliable? That seems to be another issue outside the framework of Havner.
Well, it is another level of indicia that you should consider is the course of the study. And again, that's one of the things that makes this case easier because most of the studies came from Merck. We're not relying on a competitor or some rogue scientist as in Havner, but Merck studies themselves that reach these conclusions.
It seems to me that the main contest is not so much that this drug can cause cardiovascular events. It's just at this dosage and this duration. And I mean, I think that you'd have a much easier case over a longer period of time. And so there, it would be helpful to look at the actual studies in terms of relative dose and duration.
In terms of dose, Your Honor, that almost all the studies we rely on are the same dose, 25 milligrams. There's one, the first one, Vigor, was at 50 milligrams, and I think there's one at 12.5, but most of them are 25 milligrams. In terms of duration, first of all, let me point this out. Almost none of these studies were undertaken for the purpose of determining whether Vioxx caused an increase in cardiovascular risk. They were taken to study other things, and the number of cardiovascular events kind of jumped out at the people doing the study, and so they commented on them. But most of the studies were not under, the scientists say they were not powered for duration, which means they were not undertaken in order to prove how long it would take. Some of the studies were a three-year study, and what we know is at the end of 3 years, this is the number of events there were. But we rely on several studies. The Protocol 90 study was a six-week study. The Juni, another meta-analysis published in The Lancet, a British medical journal, said it didn't matter how long the patients were on it, even a short duration was able to demonstrate the effect. The Solomon study, which we talked about, says the results were observable throughout the study period, regardless of how long the drug had been taken. And then the Victor study, which is in tab B of your bench exhibit, has the chart that shows when the serious cardiovascular event started to occur, and it's immediate. So are there any studies saying taking 25 milligrams for 23 days, double the risk? Well, no, because there's no study that, and all we have is what Merck has done.
But you're saying if you take pieces of different studies, then you get the significance that the effects start immediately.
That's right.
And the other studies have the 25 milligrams.
Right.
And nothing in Hafner says it has to be one study.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And the way that Vioxx works, and the reason it causes cardiovascular risk, is there are these two kinds of enzymes. There's one that causes clots and one that breaks up clots. And with Vioxx, you let the enzyme go that causes clots, but you suppress the enzyme that breaks up clots. And so that's why it creates a danger. And that could happen at any time. Just as the drugs say they're fast-acting, provide fast-acting pain relief, they also immediately start to have that effect. And it's different in different people. But at some point, it's going to cause, I mean, in a lot of people, it's going to cause a clot and suppress the enzyme that breaks up the clot. And there's no reason why that wouldn't begin until 18 or 30 months later.
The Garza had no history of clots before this event?
Yes, Your Honor. But none for several years before this. The last procedure he had was in 98, and his heart attack occurred in 2001. I say he has a history of clots. I don't know that that's true. He had coronary artery disease, which caused a narrowing of the arteries, but I don't know that he ever had any history of clots, come to think of it.
How does the fact that he had a previous cardiac infarction before this come into play? Is that something for the gatekeeper to consider?
I don't think it's a gatekeeper issue. It's one of the factors that you consider in terms of causation. But I would hate to see the court adopt a rule that says anybody who's ever had a heart attack of any sort can never again sue for heart attack and prove causation. You mentioned you'd have one, Your Honor. And I've had a heart attack myself 4 years ago, and I don't think that means that I can never take a drug that will cause me to have a heart attack.
Is Vioxx on the market today?
It's not, Your Honor. It was removed from the market, I believe, in 2004, maybe 2005.
And how should that play in this analysis, the fact that it's been removed from the market?
I'm sorry. Oh, how should that play in this analysis? That's some evidence that Merck knew that they had a problem with Vioxx. I don't think it's necessarily conclusive, but that's one of the factors the court should consider.
Well, that's post-trial evidence, so.
No, it was
removed from the market before trial, and it was discussed at trial, and it was because of a Merck clinical trial, the approved study, that the Merck made a decision to take it off. Even though it was the most profitable drug in the history of Merck, they took it off the market because of concerns about cardiovascular risk.
You make much of the fact that Merck did not include patients with histories of cardiovascular events in the study. Can you elaborate on that just a little bit?
I can, Your Honor, because the studies might have been more helpful in terms of whether Vioxx causes problems for people with a history of cardiovascular disease if they had included people that had those. But there are some internal emails that were introduced into evidence where someone said, why don't we allow everybody to participate in the study? And the internal email said, oh, no, that would probably generate bad results for cardiac events. And would skew the studies and would cause us to look bad. So they didn't, but it would have been a more accurate picture. Even if you exclude people with a history of heart disease, they still had these studies that show an increased risk.
So would you say that excluding them would have any effect on the 2.0 factor?
It's really impossible to determine in retrospect, Your Honor. I think if they had been included, there's a much better chance that numbers would have been higher, but I think it's difficult to say in retrospect that we can project a higher number based on that.
If you're successful on your causation argument at this court, the case goes back for a retrial, is that correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Because of the jury issue, misconduct?
It was remanded by the San Antonio Court of Appeals because of a juror misconduct issue, which we chose not to challenge.
Justice Heck?
No, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court will hear rebuttal.
I'd like to use my 5 minutes to address three questions. First, the current status of Vioxx litigation. Second, a few comments on the studies. And third, the question of excluding other causes. Most of the Vioxx litigation has been settled. If the court wants to learn about the settlement, it can look at the Merck website. The settlement was announced in November 2007. Certain cases were excluded from the settlement. This case was excluded from the settlement because the settlement required that cases meet certain standards, one of which was 30 days Vioxx use documented. And this case had only 7 days of Vioxx use documented, and so it didn't qualify for the settlement. There's one other Vioxx case in the Texas system. It's coming out of the 14th Court of Appeals. The court may or may not have filed a petition for review, I'm not sure, but most of the Vioxx litigation is over. Second, with regard to the studies, I think it's important for the court in thinking about this to take into account the fact that in 2005 the FDA reviewed all of these studies, all of the 100 clinical trials that had been conducted with regard to Vioxx, and concluded a number of things, one of which was that there does not appear to be any risk associated with short-term Vioxx use. So it's in that context that here we are in this case in which the plaintiffs have over the course of the case identified 12 such studies. And now today, we hear the two that they claim satisfy Havner. And again, neither of those two studies satisfies Havner. First, with regard to...
Is there anything in Havner that says it has to be one study that hits all the requirements? Because some of these studies appear to show that these effects can happen immediately. And so if you've got studies that establish that and meet the requirements of statistical significance, and you have other studies that show at 25 milligrams, you can have an effect. Why can't you combine those?
Havner specifically says you can't pick and choose parts of studies. Havner talks about, Havner establishes the requirements for an epidemiological study that a plaintiff seeks to use to prove causation. And those requirements are more than doubling the risk, statistical significance at the same dose and duration. It has to be a single study. And then Havner goes on and says that one study would not be enough. And that's why the courts have said, well, there have to be at least two studies. But yes, Havner does require that, and Havner specifically says that you can't choose one part of a study and over another part of a study.
Well, I can understand not being able to build a quilt, but it seems like if the study shows the effects are immediate, and that's not really disputed, and other studies show 25 milligrams.
Well, no, it is hotly disputed, and I think we tried to make this clear in our chart, but there is no study that... No study that's in evidence that any expert talked about that shows that a statistically significant finding of more than doubling of the risk that the incidents begin immediately. The objection to the email, which is containing the Victor conclusions, was an objection to the very chart that Mr. DuBose has represented to the court shows that these effects begin immediately. And the objection was that whatever the chart shows, if the study is not statistically significant, then the court should not consider it. And that objection was sustained. But there is no study that shows a more than doubling of the risk, a statistically significant more than doubling of the risk at this dose, 25 milligrams, and this duration less than 30 days.
Counsel, in the opposing counsel referenced the Shapiro study, and they give here Plaintiff's Exhibit 132, that has dosage at various, including 25 milligrams, and duration various, including less than 30 days. Can you address that study? That's one that they rely on specifically.
Yeah, Shapiro is a meta-analysis in which the investigator relied upon multiple studies, one of which was the Vigor study. That was the biggest study in the Shapiro meta-analysis.
This is not a separate independent study. It is an analysis of multiple studies.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And just as they say here, duration was various but was not limited to a short duration.
Right.
And it had various dosages including greater than 25 milligrams?
Yes, it included Vigor. The Vigor study, 41%, and I've given the court the reference to the record. I did the math, the division to get 41%, but you can look at the chart and see that 41% of the patient years in the Shapiro meta-analysis are attributable to Vigor. Vigor was 50 milligrams, twice the dose involved here, and the duration was 9 months. If you take out Vigor, and that's in our chart as well, the relative risk drops to like 1.1, and the finding becomes statistically insignificant. Moreover, if you look at another place in Shapiro, and this is in our chart as well, and compare and see what the result is if you compare Vioxx to placebo, you again get no doubling of the risk and no statistical significance. And so if you look at the relevant part of Shapiro, it doesn't satisfy Havner and doesn't support the plaintiff's case. I think I'm out of time unless the court didn't get to all my points.
Justice Wainwright.
The third point, can you address that briefly?
I can. The plaintiffs make 2 points with regard to excluding other probable causes. The first is they say that Mr. Garza had a stable cardiac status. They overlook the fact that the stress test that he had just been given revealed an abnormality, an apical ischemia, which Dr. Posada, his treating physician, said justified a cardiac catheterization, which Dr. Simonini testified if Dr. Posada recommended a cardiac catheterization, then Mr. Garza was at risk of having a heart attack. So that's the first point.
But I understood the response to that was it was in a different part. It was in a different area of the heart, and so it couldn't have been the area where these clots formed.
Well, I don't think that's supported by the record, but it is clear that if he had had a cardiac catheterization, it would have revealed the blockage in these bypass arteries that were discovered on pathology. And the other point, Justice Wainwright, is that the primary effort that the plaintiffs made to exclude other causes was their expert's testimony that it was very rare that there were two clots. And he's relying upon the autopsy report. Three quick responses. Number one, the expert offered no scientific basis for his bare opinion that it's rare to have two clots in a heart attack event. Number two, there is no evidence anywhere in this record that Vioxx tends to cause multiple clots, that multiple clotting is a signature of a Vioxx heart attack. And number three, the only pathologist to testify, Dr. Wheeler, and the only person to look at these slides under high magnification concluded that they were not clots, but rather they were hemorrhages within the plaque. And no one claims that Vioxx causes hemorrhages within the plaque. And we submit that under City of Keller, the Wheeler testimony should be credited because it demonstrates that the assumption that Simonini made and that the coroner made that these were clots is simply false, and that this is a situation in which testimony that might appear to be competent becomes incompetent when you look at the scientific evidence. So that's the quick response on that.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.